0-1 to Poole. In the air, left field, and Pujols has given St. Louis the lead. A dramatic, towering three-run home run. Stunned in disbelief here in Houston.
And welcome to another one of our special Meet Me at Musials. I'm your host, Daniel Shoptoff, C70 at the Bat, and at C70 on Twitter. And with me is Kyle Reese from the Redbird Daily, Kyler R416 on Twitter. And obviously, we're here to talk some minor league ball, even though the seasons have been done for quite some time, except for Memphis, who had a nice little run there in the postseason, didn't they, Kyle?
That was a lot of fun to watch, too. There's a managerial rant I could go on a little bit. They won the PCL championship, and then they lost to the Durham Bulls in, like, the AAA championship game. It's a singular game. It was a heck of a game. It was fun to watch. Memphis got off to an early lead, fueled by Jose Adolis Garcia. Dakota Hudson pitched three great innings, and then there was a little interesting bullpen management, as it were, that maybe would have rivaled the Cardinals' own major league manager and how mismanaged it was. It was almost like that there's a playbook that the organization is handing down from manager to manager in important games and how to manage a bullpen. But they ended up losing that game. It was a really good game. From a person who just likes to watch prospects, Tampa Bay, who is affiliated with the Durham Bulls, has a starting pitching prospect named Brent Honeywell, who just shut down the Cardinals over the last four or five innings of that game. It was, if you can separate yourself emotionally from what was going on in that game, it was actually fun to watch that kid deal, but it was a really great game. And a lot of the Cardinals' young talent was on display. And it was nice to see one of the teams take it a little distance, because the only other team that played for a championship sort of was Palm Beach. And they were co-champion because of the hurricanes that were going on in Florida, so they had to cut that playoff short. So yeah, that's Memphis. It was a fun little run there.
To go back a little bit, not to really set you off on the managerial rant, but was that more? You know, there's been a lot, and obviously we're not going to get into the topic too much, but there's been people, bring up Stubby, let him manage the Cardinals. Was that out of character for him, or is that something that, he couldn't have struggled with it too much with a 90-something win team, but is that something that reared its head some during the year?
They didn't play, this might sound crazy, and I wonder a lot about this with, appraising Mike Matheny early in his career. That 90-plus win team for Memphis, they would get off to these early leads, these big early leads, and there wasn't like urgency late in games. There weren't a lot of opportunities for a manager to have to like push himself to make an important decision. He could stick with his guys because a lot of times there was a 3-run lead or a 4-run lead, something like that where maybe he didn't have to have the urgency. In the championship game at AAA, the Memphis Redbirds rather were winning 3-1, and he brought in Josh Zide, who was a minor league free agent who pitched amazing for Team Israel during the World Baseball Classic. He started a little bit early on in the year for Memphis, and he tailed off. He got off to a good start, tailed off. They moved into the bullpen where they were trying to get other younger, higher, better prospects into the rotation. And they brought him in, and he didn't have any control, and the bases were loaded, and they didn't have any interest in warming up anyone. And then Colton Wong's little brother, Keen Wong, hit a grand slam. And during that entire process, Josh did not have any control or any command. And again, there was no go to the bullpen. There was no sense of urgency there. And to me, that's one of those things that you hope that Stubby learns from. His first foray as a manager of a team, and it's, in my opinion, it's completely acceptable that it's something that he might have struggled with or might have had a problem with, because I just don't think that he had a lot of experience dealing with that level of urgency. He trusted his guy, I believe Josh Zide was one of only four players who played at Memphis from the beginning to the end. So he probably thought, you know what, we're here in this AAA championship game. I'm just going to stick with my guy. And if we die with him, we die with him. If we win with him, we win with him. But that's the kind of thinking that, you know, as we know with Mr. Matheny and maybe some of his bullpen management, that can really, really get you in trouble. But I do think, you know, the long-form way of answering your question is, I just think it's an experience issue. I think maybe if things had been different throughout the year and he had to maybe rearrange the bullpen in more pressing times during games, he probably would have been maybe a little bit more prepared for that. Or maybe he didn't necessarily understand the levity of the situation, which I hope isn't the case, but I can't say for sure. It's not something I'm particularly worried about. But it also shows you how important it is to have actual game management under your belt when you become a manager at the major league level, because there's just so many things that are flowing during a game. You have to be, especially in those circumstances, you have to be a little bit more conservative and reactionary than you might be, you know, just let your guys go.
Yeah, and there is a difference between your first year and your sixth year. Do you think also, I mean, for us, for me, I mean, not being really privy to a lot of this stuff, but it felt like, I would think, that the PCL championship, the PCL championship would have meant more than this one game. It felt like this was almost an exhibition. Even though it was for a championship, it almost kind of came across as an exhibition, and maybe that played into the thinking some as well. Like you said, that you're not paying attention to, you know, well, either not paying attention to the gravity or really not assigning it any gravity, because this was kind of just like this bonus game where if you won, great, but if not, you'd already had an awesome season.
Yeah, that might be true. And that was kind of like, I discarded it as that initially. But then I think about how Tampa Bay, or how the Durham Bulls handled the game. And, you know, Keen Wong went up there and hit a grand slam and was a triple short of the cycle. And the manager, who I have no idea who the manager is for the Durham Bulls, he held his best pitcher out for the last four or five innings of the game to shut that thing down. Mm. So, it, you know, maybe from the Cardinals perspective or from the Memphis perspective, it might have been an exhibition, but what the Durham Bulls did was they handled it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a good thing. And I know, again, it doesn't take away from what Memphis did, but it would have been nice, especially with how they played that game and having a chance to win it, for them to have taken the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit, now that the season is done, and let's talk a little bit about the draft class from 2017. We've talked about a lot of the guys all year long that have been in the organization and things like that, but, you know, some of these new guys only got about a month or so of playing time, if that. In this limited time, what have you seen?
It's been a very, very interesting draft class, and not because they didn't have, you know, their first two and a half picks, depending on, you know, compensation picks. In this particular instance, it was two picks, their first and their second rounder, because of, you know, the hacking scandal and Dexter Fowler and signing Dexter Fowler and all that. It's a very, very interesting and maybe even like expectedly, which isn't a word, typical draft class. Early on, they drafted a lot of college senior juniors, and you expect those guys to come in, especially in the draft picks in the first 10 rounds, to come in and do really well at the lower levels. And that's exactly what happened. Scott Hurst, who was their first pick, third rounder, 94th overall, had a very, very solid season. He's a left-handed hitting, right-handed throwing, center fielder-ish. That's still up for debate. Again, when you're only 21 years old, there's still plenty of time to really figure out exactly what's going on. But he slashed .282, .354, and then he had an OPS of .786. And, you know, three home runs. He did exactly what you would expect at the state college level. He was impressive. He didn't necessarily, shine so bright that you would think, oh, wait, this might be something, like, amazing. This might be a diamond in the rough with your third round pick. But he had a really solid season. There are, like, early on in the draft, there are a couple guys worth mentioning from a hitting perspective. And it's more because of the level they ended at than it is exactly how they performed, although they performed well. Two of the guys are Kramer Robertson, who was the shortstop and fourth round pick that the Cardinals took out of LSU. Kramer probably isn't a shortstop. He probably profiles a little bit better as a second baseman. But he hit really well, and he did it at Peoria, which is a full season club. And anytime you have a draftee end at a full season club, the year they were drafted, is an amazing, an important thing. Kramer's a little older. He's 23. He ended the year as a 23-year-old, but it was kind of the same thing for him. He was, you know, 270, 350 as an on-base percentage, three home runs, a good amount of total bases, right around 80 total bases and 200-something at-bats. And he played solid defense. The problem with Kramer, even though his on-base percentage was 350, is that he is an aggressive hitter. Early on, Peoria had him hitting early in the lineup, you know, first, second, and he's just too aggressive to hit early in a lineup. He's, unless that part of his game matures, which it very well could, he's better suited for the back end of a lineup. And like I said, I love the idea of him at second base. I don't know how strong his arm is at third. It's definitely not strong enough to play short, but he was really interesting. So he's the other one. And then one of my favorite prospects, and he's earned this, is Evan Mendoza. And Mendoza's really interesting. He was drafted. A lot of people thought he might be, again, a typical Cardinal draftee, where is he going to be a relief pitcher? Is he going to be a starting pitcher? Is he going to be a third baseman? And the Cardinals turn him into a third baseman, which is where he's played before. I say they turn him into a third baseman, but he already had a template for that. And he started the season at State College, and he had enough at-bats to qualify to win their batting title. And then he finished the year at Peoria. And when he first came up at Peoria, he struggled a little bit, but he went on a run in the last week or so. He was good for Peoria during their playoff push, and he's a really interesting kid. So, again, I bring those two up especially because they finished at Peoria. And anytime, again, I repeat myself, but anytime that you have a prospect who finishes at a full season level the year they are drafted, and they do it well, that's a really encouraging thing, especially for a hitter. Pitchers, it can be a little bit more difficult to gauge that, but especially for a hitter. And then, again, early on, to me, made the steal of the draft, and I haven't watched enough of his video to be able to say. I preface this by saying this time last year I was big on Andrew Kisner. He had a stat line that was really, really impressive. He was playing a little first and playing catcher, and he was a really interesting guy to keep an eye on. I feel the same way about Chase Pinder, who was their seventh round pick out of Clemson, right now that I felt about Andrew Kisner this time last year. And we know what kind of year Kisner had. He blew up. He's a legitimate catching prospect now. He's put himself on the prospect map. There's a good chance that when I re-rank my prospects, he'll be in my top 20 list. But Pinder is really interesting. Again, seventh round pick out of Clemson. What I like most, and again, he was at Johnson City. He's only 21 years old. Again, Johnson City in 21, he's advanced for that level. That's not like the level he should be at. He probably should have been at State College, but State College had enough outfielders. And also they want to give Scott Hurst a good amount of time in center field. Pinder is also a center fielder. He also had to split time with another prospect named Wade Infante. But Pinder is really interesting. His on-base percentage was .442. He had a batting average of .320, three home runs, 74 total bases, and 169 at-bats. Again, that's you want that kind of production out of a player out of a major program like Clemson at the age of 21 at the Johnson City level, which is the lowest level that isn't Gulf Coast League in the minors. But the fact that he did it, and he did it while striking out very little and walking a lot and still driving the ball, that's really, really encouraging. I'll be keeping a very close eye on Pinder as the 2018 season starts. And then the pitching out of the 2017 draft class has been really interesting. A lot of these guys are almost exclusively bullpen arms, which is really, really interesting. Some of them did start in college, and it's not it's typical that starters in college in their first year after being drafted will just be exclusively in the bullpen to monitor innings. But I do think there's a very good chance that some of these guys will stick in the bullpen. And that'll be a really interesting thing to watch. A couple names that come to mind: Andrew Somerville, who was a 12th round pick. Jacob Patterson, who's one of my favorites. He's a true loogie. He dominated Johnson City. He was a save monster at Johnson City. He's a prototypical left-handed reliever. Like I said, total loogie. And then they had a couple guys late in the draft. A gentleman named Evan Gilroy, or Galori, I believe, who, you know, still a lot to learn about him. But he's 21. He was from University of Louisiana Lafayette, and he had he almost struck out a guy in an inning. He had a really solid ERA. It was like 2.8. Over Johnson City and Palm Beach. He ended the season in Palm Beach. And then another interesting guy is Cody Whiteley, who was a 27th round pick, and he fell to the 27th round because he had Tommy John surgery. Missed nearly the entire season, and he dominated out of the bullpen for Johnson City. And that'll be a really interesting thing to keep an eye on. But those are the couple things that stuck with me. They had a couple guys, Evan Mendoza in particular, Chase Pinder in particular, who, in my opinion, overshot what I would have expected out of them. And then they had a lot of really solid performances out of the bullpen at lower levels out of college-age kids, which you cannot put too much stock in, but you can still get kind of excited about. And then I guess the only other thing that sticks out to me is, as I rant for the last, I think this is 45 minutes now, it seems like, But there were three big names that went to the Gulf Coast League. Terry Fuller, who everyone knows at this point. Zach Jackson, who was a sixth-round pick and a catcher, but probably is a first baseman. And pitcher Wilberto Rivera. And all three of those guys struggled mightily at that level. And that's not uncommon for 18-year-old kids to struggle at the Gulf Coast League. It just would have been nice if one of them would have done something to differentiate themselves from the rest of the group, you know, to get a little excited about.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to ask you about Fuller, because like you said, he's a guy that, you know, a lot of hype, I don't want to say hype around, but there was a lot of, well, maybe that's the right word for it, drawing him away from college and the power bat that he had, so... Any struggles that we're seeing right now, you don't think are really a concern yet just because of age and where they're at?
I am almost completely dismissive of any high school aged player the year after they're drafted. There's just so much going on, right? It's like going to college for the first time. It's like being a freshman in college for the first time. They're more than likely displaced from their homes. They're moving into a campus situation. They're getting instruction, you know, on a full schedule. It's like a course load. And most true freshmen do not perform well in college. A lot of true freshmen end up getting redshirted to get another year of eligibility out of. That's how I view a lot of 18-year-old kids drafted out of high school. And that's exactly what happened with Terry Fuller and what happened with Zach Jackson, Wilberto Rivera. It happened with Dylan Carlson last year. You just want to see signs of success. And there was a period there with Terry Fuller where he hit a couple home runs, he was stealing some bases, he wasn't striking out as much as he did because he struck out 49 times in 118 at-bats, which is a lot and concerning, of course. But it is what it is. But there was a short period of time there where he really excelled. Again, you don't want to – it's not all sunshines. It's not all rainbows. But that's – like, I want to see moments of sustained success out of those kids. Even if those moments are as small of a sample size as five games, I want to see that because that's rare for an 18-year-old playing at any level, in the minor league level, that didn't come from like a Dominican league where there was structure and organization. So, you know, with a guy like Terry Fuller, he did exactly as you would expect. He slashed 240 or 161, 242, and that's not good. It's miserable. He had three home runs, three doubles, but that's not an alarming. None of that's alarming. That's okay. Zach Jackson's a little bit different because he didn't hit an extra base hit, and his average was below .100. maybe be a little bit more concerned about him. But again, it's still the same thing with him. You have to see where he's at after a full off season of club dictated workouts, diet, and you know, just work in general, and then adjust next year and maybe be a little bit more concerned if he's hitting 161 again this time next year.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I just, you know, everybody wants those guys to just jump in and tear it up and, you know, be in the major leagues in a year and a half, and it just doesn't go that way, unfortunately. Not for most normal people, at least. So, we got. I think this transitions. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe because we'll find out. We want to talk. You know, the next thing that Kyle's actually prepared to talk about is people that are going to be traded this offseason, or at least have the chance to be traded in this, you know, overarching shakeup that the Cardinals continue to say they're going to have. But maybe as it relates to that, maybe not. Who are guys, and we've probably talked about it, but I just want to kind of maybe have it as a baseline here. Who are the guys that need to be added to the 40-man this year or be exposed to the Rule 5 draft?
So the first couple that come to mind are, like, the easy ones. Austin Gomber is the first one. You know, that's a – I'm going to stop myself because I will go on and on about the Austin Gomber situation. And we're going to talk about that here in a couple minutes with your dynamite transition that you nailed right there. But Gomber's one, Oscar Mercado's one, and it might. So the other, there's one person that I'm still trying to figure out, and I haven't had the time that I wanted to invest into it. Patrick Wisdom is a really, really interesting thing to me because I don't believe that the Cardinals have his rights after the season. I believe he can walk as a minor league free agent, but I haven't done the groundwork. And then, at the very least, he is eligible for the Rule 5 draft again for what I believe is his third season, if that's the case. And, you know, there's a team that's going to take him, and they're going to use him properly off a bench, if that is the case. But I really do think he's eligible to be a minor league free agent, and I apologize to anyone who's listening for not having that exact information. But, you know, that is the baseline of the names, as small as it is to, like, really worry about and think about. You know, Arturo Reyes is another name. He's also going to be part of the Arizona Fall League club. But, you know, there's a couple other names in there, but I don't think that they're going to be names worth worrying about or thinking about exactly.
Well, I was thinking that Tyler O'Neill needed to be. Is that not accurate?
Oh, God. You know, the funny thing is, and this goes to show you where my mind is with Tyler O'Neill. I'm so sold on Tyler O'Neill as a potential, like, major league impact bat in, like, a year and a half, 2 years, that I don't even think about him as not being on the 40-man. You are 100% correct. He needs to be added to the 40-man, but it's – in my mind, it's such a formality that I've blown past it because he is exactly what the organization doesn't have. And unless they end up using him to get someone like Giancarlo Stanton, there's no logical reason to move him because he is, with his power and potential middle of the order bat and solid outfielding in the corners. And, you know, he can play center in a pinch at the minor league level. I doubt he can do it at the major league level when people still like him. But he is the one rarity. He is a unicorn in this organization. He's the only thing that is like him in the organization. So I just blow right by him because I can't imagine them trading him or moving him or not adding him unless it's for somebody who has that same type of ceiling.
Yeah, I figured that was the case, but, you know, sometimes you hear things and they're not actually accurate, so I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, obviously these are guys that either need to be put on or need to be shipped out, along with, you know, others that are not quite to that point yet. So who are we talking about that might be going elsewhere this offseason?
Well, we'll start with those two names that we brought up. In my mind, just because of how it all ended, the season ended for Austin Gomber, I cannot imagine a situation if the Cardinals are involved in a trade for something that's going to make their major league club better that Austin Gomber isn't involved in. Austin Gomber dominated once he got healthy in the second half of the Springfield season. Memphis was on a playoff run. They had questionable pitching because a lot of the pitching had funneled to the major league level. And instead of giving Austin Gomber a promotion to Memphis for the playoff run, his season ended after Springfield. And his innings were nearly the exact same as it was in 2016, so it wasn't a matter of like curtailing his innings. He actually, in my opinion, he actually needs more innings to prepare himself for the next level, the next push, the next stress. And they shut him down. And he had to be added to the 40-man, so say they didn't want to impede what was going on in Memphis, which wasn't the case, but say they didn't want to impede what was going on in Memphis, they could have added him to the 40-man and brought him up to the major league level and let him pitch in tonight's game, which is, the worst game of the season, and at least been interested in him and see what you had and get a chance to, like, really, really appraise him at the major league level against a team like the AAA, the Iowa Cubs, that the Cardinals are playing tonight. So I would think that any deal that would upgrade the major league level would start with Austin Gomber because of the way his season ended. He was too good to not get a promotion, and he didn't get a promotion. There's been a lot of talk about him and the Cardinals organization having some friction about his motion and how he throws. Again, it seems like that's a lot of speculation that I've heard from a lot of experts. I've read it on BA, Baseball America, that is. I've seen Derek Gould talk about it a little bit, but none of it seems substantiated. Gomber's never really commented on it. The Cardinals have never necessarily commented on it. It just seems like there's a little bit of friction there and a little bit of question, and a kid who deserved a promotion that didn't get it while others were getting promotions around him. And to me, and again, he needs to be added to the 40-man, and I interpret that as, all right, this guy is where you start when it comes to trade talks, no matter what the trade talks are. I did have a question for you, because you've done such a great job of chronicling John Mozeliak's trades since becoming general manager. Other than Rob Kaminsky, can you think of a time that the Cardinals traded a pitching prospect?
You would ask that off the top of my head, but Mo doesn't trade too many actual prospects anyway. I mean, I think we saw Mortensen go in the holiday deal back in 2009, but he wasn't necessarily, he was always going to be like a quad A, fringe major leaguer. I can't think of very many. Of course, Mo is a pitching hoarder. I mean, he always has been.
Yeah.
There have been times in the past where I felt like we've got too many arms. You've got to get rid of some of these in the off season, and Mo doesn't get rid of any of them. And So no, you're right. It would be weird, but you're not bringing up Gomber, especially when this bullpen has 1,800 arms and only trusts three of them. Of course, that could be the other side of things. They didn't like Matheny, wasn't going to run him out there. Because I think we've kind of seen that with Jack Flaherty since he, I think part of it, they took him out of the rotation, I assume, to manage innings, but I don't think that was as big an issue. We've only seen him relieve once. I don't know what that's about. So maybe that's part of the deal, but you're right. It just seems weird. It really seems weird not to send him to Memphis when they could really have used him.
Yeah, and the reason I ask you that is, you start trying to project out what the Cardinals might do in the offseason. I start trying to think about, okay, what do they want to do to make this team better? There was, at the deadline, there was that rumor. I don't remember which one of the experts or, dialed-in guys said it, but that the Cardinals went after Sonny Gray and using Piscotty as one of the pieces that they were going to try to trade to get Sonny Gray. And I just think to myself, like, okay, they're willing to that tips that they're willing to trade their outfield depth. And there was also a rumor that the A's were in the market for a defensive first center fielder. The Cardinals have that. I think it's Sierra first. But I cannot think, you know, if you're using the past to inform speculation, and that's what I'm doing here, I cannot imagine a trade that would ever involve their top pitching prospects. Mm. You know, Flaherty's not going anywhere. Weaver is not going anywhere. Dakota Hudson isn't going anywhere. So you can immediately take those guys off the board. I do not believe that there's a circumstance, even for Giancarlo Stanton, where they would trade those guys. And, you know, that's, again, it's speculation. I'm using the past to inform my speculation. And that's really, really interesting to me. And that's part of the reason why I think that Domber is the best chance, or has the best chance, rather, to be traded, especially if there's friction. And, you know, one of my favorite pitching prospects is Ryan Helsley, and he made his way all the way up to Memphis and jumped over Domber and pitched and started a couple games at Memphis for their playoff run. I could definitely see him being a trade piece if they needed to. But I don't think that they're going to trade pitching. And if they do, that's a huge signal of course correction from an organizational thought standpoint. And I'll be really interested to watch that. And then from a hitting standpoint, sticking with the guys who needed to be added to the 40-man, I would assume that Oscar Mercado is one of the guys that they'd be willing to discuss because they have such a strong, you know, grouping of outfielders, and especially outfielders that can play multiple positions. And Mercado had a rough second half that I believe was aided. His struggles, rather, were aided by a shoulder injury that probably lingered a little bit. So I guess if I had to pick one pitcher and one hitter, I would think that Gomber and Mercado are one and two. I also think that, you know, if I have to steer away from the major league 40-man, because I do believe Piscotty's going to probably be on the move, I do think there's a chance Randall Grichuk's on the move. But, like, next up, I would think, again, depending on how much say Mike Matheny has in who gets traded, I would think that if Matheny doesn't have much say, then Harrison Bader would be one of the guys who would get moved. But if Matheny does have a say, I would imagine that Harrison Bader is the kind of guy that Mike Matheny would really, really like to have, and that I would think Jose Adolis Garcia would be a really, really enticing trade piece. But that's what I see. I don't know what to expect out of this club because I don't know where they're at. You know, you hear what Bill DeWitt says in a Q&A with Derek Gould, and it completely throws you into a big ball, like a big you're in the fetal position. You're trying to figure out what's going on. So, you know, I guess, again, if I had to say, it would be Helsley and Gomber, I think, are the two most likely to get traded from a pitching prospect standpoint. I don't think they're going to trade Jordan Hicks for anything. And then from a hitting standpoint, I think Mercado and then either Bader or Jose Adolis Garcia have the best chance of getting traded because I like their value. They have really strong, hearty value. Whereas, like, someone like Magnura Sierra, who has proved himself at the major league level for the Cardinals, might not necessarily have that hearty value for another team in Major League Baseball.
As the Cardinals just now start their offseason, basically, since they've just lost to the Cubs and are now eliminated, I just wanted to throw that in there. It really has nothing else to do with anything except, you know, slightly depressing everybody. Things that I was thinking of when you said that. One, it is interesting that the only two deals that Michael Gersh has on his resume, and you can argue how much the Gersh had involved, but he is the guy that it's in his era, traded away pitching. You know, you traded away Marco Gonzalez and you traded away Mike Leake. Now, those are not Luke Weaver or Alex Reyes or anything like that, but it is maybe more pitching than they're usually giving away. Secondly, I think interesting, you mentioned Garcia, and obviously he's not going to centerpiece a deal of this magnitude, but it would be interesting if Miami is looking to put a team that looks like the city on the field.
Yeah.
Then Garcia would seem to be a guy that could go in a package for an outfielder down there. because he's cheap and, you know, he's got the right ethnic makeup for that area.
Yeah. Yeah, that was part of the that's a great read. That's exactly why I was part of the reason why I was bringing him up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did a lot to stabilize his stock because there were some questions about, you know, how he would perform. It's pretty common knowledge now at this point that in the Japanese minor leagues, he struggled about as bad as a player can struggle in any form in any professional or semi-professional league in baseball after being an MVP in the Cuban League. And he had a kind of a weird year, but he stabilized that. He's a perfect fit for Miami. And if the Cardinals have any interest in trading for Giancarlo Stanton, you know, he mirrors Marcelo Zuna a bit, in my opinion. I think he's a better fielder for a corner than Marcelo Zuna is. But I don't know if he has, like, the bust-open power that Ozuna has. He has power. But he really does fit in there. I think that's a really good read. Real fast, that game tonight ended on a Paul DeJong home run. He put that thing there's nothing more perfect for you and I to have our end of year little talk here than Paul DeJong putting a ball over the wall with the Cardinals on life support that the center fielder for the Cubs robs to end the Cardinals' life. And I just a quick little annotation. Exactly. That's the only emotion that a Cardinals fan can have at that is just it's 30%. All right, that was going to happen. How did I not know that was going to happen? 65%, this is the worst thing on earth. And then 5%, just put me out of my misery. And that's what we just saw.
And you might think that's a slightly strange place to end this thing, but about that time, Kyle's connection with Skype got to the point where we couldn't hear, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't recording. So we've cut it off right there. Didn't get much farther into it, but obviously hate to have Kyle go out like that. Asked Kyle on Twitter. It looks like he and Colin are going to try, if they can get their schedules to work out, to do a Arizona Fall League preview before over there on Prospect to be named later, which if you're not subscribed to, you should probably go do so that whenever they do get another episode out, you'll have it ready to go. Obviously, if you haven't, you are subscribed, hopefully, to Maybe It Mutual. Would also encourage you to rate and review or give us feedback. I have noticed that it seems to me, at least, that the new podcast app on iTunes with the new iTunes 11 seems to make it much easier to do the rating and reviewing. The stars right there and the review spots are there. So if you'll do that, we would appreciate it so that more people can hear our ramblings, which is obviously what we're looking for. Alan and I will be with you tomorrow night talking about the final nail in the coffin of the Cardinals being eliminated and playing some meaningless baseball for the first time since 2010. We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about a project that he and I have gotten started. You may have seen it on the Twitters today, but we'll be talking some more about that and some other things that are coming up, especially on my blog. And kind of looking forward to this offseason, what we're going to do, what our plans are for that. So, hopefully you'll listen to this one, then listen to those when they go up late Friday night or early Saturday morning as we fill this last weekend of baseball with some podcasts because, yay, why not? So I'm Daniel, and for Kyle, we'll see you later.
Shooter from the belt to the plate. A swing and a miss, and that's a winner! That's a winner! A World Series winner for the Cardinals!